This is XTP Media.
It's not to shy them away from the aviation enthusiasts. It's just that, you know, it's a lump of metal worth a lot of money.
Right.
So
yeah.
We're only custodians of them. We don't ever own a cockpit. We're just custodians.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Welcome to the latest episode of Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast. And we're ready for takeoff.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 116 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today I'm joined by Tim Robinson, and Tim is Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, how are you today?
Very well, thank you. Yeah, good to be here.
Yeah, good to be back. And we have a guest with us today, and he is enthusiast and author Gavin Hoffman. Gavin, welcome to Extended.
Thank you very much for having me.
No, it's a delight to have you. And we're going to get to your latest book, Restoration Force, later. But just before we talk about some news, where does your interest in aviation come from?
Good question. It goes back from since I could walk. My father used to work away quite a lot, and when he would come back, he would come back with postcards of 747s of Pakistan International Airways and Air Portugal. And so for as long as I can remember, I was always fed pictures of aircraft, and it just grew from there and just never really went away, to be honest.
Yeah, and just so everyone knows, that's your little dog in the background there. Did I read somewhere that you were brought up in and around the Wiltshire area, where, you know, there are a lot of military bases?
Yeah, correct. I grew up in a little village just outside of Swindon, South Marston. So most people would know that now as the Honda plant. But during World War II, so a lot of the airfield is still there. And obviously they used to make Spitfires there. So yeah, again, as I was growing up, we were always fed the stories of the locals with the Spitfires coming out of the paint shops and all of that. So yeah, that was right on my doorstep. So yeah, from a young age, knew about the Spitfire.
Well, listen, we're going to come back and talk about the book. It's an interesting topic we've not covered anywhere, and I'm fascinated by it. But first, let's just take a little look and have a discussion about a few things that have caught our eye in the news. So, Tim, let's kick off with the main topic from our last programme, Ingenuity. Of course, we saw it released by Perseverance, and we were eagerly awaiting for its first flight. And what a success it has been so far. We record on the 27th of April today, and hope to see a little bit more of it, but it's already caused such a storm in the space sector, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, what an achievement, flying a helicopter on another planet. So it's now had three flights on Mars. So the first one was just a quick up and down. Now it's moving laterally, and obviously, as in flight test on on terrestrial, on Earth, you expand the envelope. So that's what they're doing. So yeah, the idea is further, higher, faster, and really sort of, you know, kind of gradually you know, expand its sort of performance and its range, really. Really exciting stuff. I mean, what's a couple of interesting things there? It contains a tiny bit of the Wright Flyer of from 1903. So the Wright Brothers original flyer, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Which I think the Smithsonian, and I might have to double check this, but I'm pretty sure that they confirmed that this is the same piece of fabric or that had also been to the moon on Apollo 11.
Ah, wow. Wow.
So that is pretty...
Yeah, I wonder if it'll ever come back to Earth. Then,
that should be in a museum. You know, if there's ever an aviation museum on Mars, that is the first exhibit right there. And also cool because it the first the landing site, takeoff site. I think it's now got an ARCO code. IARCO has given it a code, an airport code, and spinning up, it actually performed better than expected.
Yeah,
because obviously the rotors span the dust off.
Okay.
So obviously everyone thinking, oh well, you know, I wonder. I hope it doesn't get covered in dust, and you know, the solar panel kind of gets covered in dust and it doesn't work. And well, hang on, if you've got something there that's like basically a fan, a big fan pointed upwards, it's going to blow all that off, isn't it?
Yeah, fascinating. It's fascinating, and there's lots of space news again this week, Tim. We've just seen the Crew 2 launch on the SpaceX Dragon to the ISS, but SpaceX are continuing to dominate the news. They got the award of the NASA Moon Lander. To me, that was a bit of a shock. Did it shock you?
A little bit, yes. So SpaceX put in for the commercial crew. It's part of NASA's Artemis program, and it is intended to land America's next astronauts on the moon. So a high profile, kind of contract to win, and the equivalent of the LEM. So groom, yeah. Think the Grumman's LEM that was built in for the Apollo program. And it was up against stiff competition, and it was a national team that had Blue Origin, Lockheed Martin, another group by Dynatics, and it came in lower price. So obviously SpaceX is known for beating everybody, to the... But also, I think they would because they were flying hardware. So the lander is absolutely huge. It's based on Starship, which is the thing that is now being tested in South Texas.
Yeah.
And that SpaceX is now trying to land vertically. So they're flying this, it seems like every other day, but it's basically an oversized rocket, a spaceship to go to Mars.
Yeah.
So some people have pointed out that transferring from the Orion will like be, you know, the Orion, NASA's Orion capsule, which is kind of a scaled up Apollo type capsule, to Starship would like be going from a for the landing would like be kind of going from a stuck in a Volkswagen Beetle to all of a sudden being given like a coach for the landing. So on some aspects, it's head scratching because the thing is going to Starship in moon orbit where it will dock with Gateway. Well, moon orbit, but where it will dock with Gateway. So the Gateway will be in SLS will launch Orion. Orion will go to Gateway, dock there. Orion's the Gateway is the lunar space station. Astronauts then transfer to Starship. Starship lands. Starship at its current size will dwarf Gateway. It'll be the spaceship will actually be bigger than the space station. So, this kind of you do think, oh well, this seems a bit you know, so mod.
Tim is
the size of it on the surface. But I think what is happening there is, to their credit, NASA are thinking ahead,
yeah,
and they are thinking, what else, we want to future proof this. We don't want to do the Apollo thing where you just touch down, grab a few rocks, and then leg it. What do we need for sustainable exploration? So the mass, the oversized, you know, overkill that Starship provides, it's got two airlocks. All right, and you know, the amount of cargo that you could potentially haul down there, drop down there, or take off, or whatever. I think the NASA are kind of being quite canny in thinking ahead and thinking, yeah, this has got the payload for, you know, lots and lots.
Yeah, it's going to take a lot of mass up there, isn't it?
Yeah, lots and lots of people, you know. And this is something for sustained exploration of you know, the moon. We're coming back. We're staying. So yeah, I mean, a really brave decision, because the incoming NASA administrator is a big SLS fan.
Could this though, Tim? Could this ultimately? I mean, SLS is a bit of a dinosaur already, isn't it? Could we just see that this spacecraft will ultimately do the job on its own?
I think a lot of people are already suggesting that. I think the problem is there is politics.
Yeah. But how many SLS rockets can they build? I mean, we've only got one at the moment, haven't we? You know, they cost a fortune. They've taken forever. I'm not knocking it. I love it. I can't wait to see it go. But the reality is that you can see Elon Musk, he's just building his ship to go to Mars, and this is a lovely little test for it. So,
well, there's another alternative competing theory to it is that I've seen suggested is NASA had to choose SpaceX, and the reason being is, if you didn't, Elon would get there himself.
Yeah,
and
true. Yeah.
And the US would be second. It would be beaten to the moon by SpaceX. You know, NASA would so better have him on board, and you know, have him on board and working towards that goal, with all the engineering talent that SpaceX, that then run the risk of, sort of like being second, and then somebody, and then having kind of egg on your face as to, well, why didn't you choose SpaceX when they've done it cheaper and faster and better, you know, that kind of stuff. I'm quite surprised that they didn't go with there wasn't some sort of backup plan. Just in case Starship doesn't work out, you will be the next preferred bidder, and you should keep working on it. And this is our contingency plan. So that's a bit surprising.
Money, no doubt. Let's move on then. Really sad news for all those geeks out there. Supertanker, the 747 Supertanker, the owners have decided that they're no longer going to continue with that service, and it's been withdrawn. Sad news, really, because it's unique, isn't it?
Well, I think it's not just unique, but... So the reason that it's still a little bit unclear as to why it's ceased ops and they're going to sort of sell it, it seems to be to do with certification and modifications to the drop system, and maybe also operating costs, that it's maybe, you know, kind of people thinking, well, maybe, yeah, I'd love to. It looks great, but maybe it's too big for some of the fires that you have. However, you look at all the, before COVID struck, you look at all the you know, wildfires, bushfires that were going on around the world, you know, and that was one of the number one things that was on the news. You know, Australia and California and everywhere was being hit by, you know, just really dry seasons, and the fire seasons were getting worse and worse. And I think you know, getting rid of an asset like that, you know, and you know, someone buys it and decides, well, actually, I'm going to convert it back into a freighter. You know, would be incredibly short-sighted, because then you'd be like, oh, hang on, we've got rid of COVID, but fire season's back, and this part of the world is aflame, and has everyone got a really big tanker?
Yeah, because it was the biggest. I mean, listed at 20,000 gallons, was certified at 19,200 by the FAA. But I noticed in the article that we were looking at that there does seem to be some sort of restriction on how much it could carry. But saying that, even at 19 or 17,000 gallons, the next biggest air tanker is the Russian Ilyushin 76, you know, 11,000 gallons. Even the DC-10, I was really surprised, only held 11,000 gallons. So this is unique, and as you say, let's hope we don't get to feel like that decision is the wrong one in a year or two's time. Let's move on to some autonomy and jump down to Airbus. Airbus are testing some more autonomous systems in their new helicopter, Tim. Their project's called Vertex, codenamed Vertex. It's a flight lab. What are they up to here? Because is this autonomous, or is this pilot assistance, or
It's sort of pilot assistance, really, but a fair smattering of autonomy, especially in the AI image recognition. So basically, what they're doing is Flight Lab is their sort of demonstrator, and it's based on a H-130 kind of light helicopter. And what they're doing, we're packing it with gizmos to really reduce the workload, improve safety, decrease operating costs. And what they're trying to test actually is a really sort of far future type of stuff, of basically piloting a helicopter using a tablet. So the idea is basically you'd get an iPad, and you'd you'd just press on your destination, and the helicopter would take off. It'd fly there, navigate itself there, and it'd land automatically.
I suppose it's just a big drone, isn't it? Helicopter.
So you can see that all of this is enabled by sensors. So they've got cameras on it. They've got LiDAR on it. They've got image processing, so you recognize obstacles at low level. And autonomy and stuff in there. They've got fly-by-wire added to it. But you can see how this, you know, kind of ultra-sophisticated autopilot would migrate to the kind of things, not just for retrofitting to helicopters, to existing helicopters. You've got a very sophisticated autopilot here. Hit a button on a map or whatever, and it will just take you there. But also, you can imagine, you can imagine that how this sort of technology will then merge, then lead into urban air mobility and the kind of things that's being talked about there. So de-skilling the pilot, but providing a pilot assistant to these first iterations, and then maybe further on, you know, you're there as a passenger. You're getting into an air taxi. You're pressing a you're just touching an iPad. You say, I want to go there, and it takes off and it takes you there. So really, you know, kind of cutting edge stuff.
Yeah. Gavin, let me bring you in here. Jumping the gun a little bit to what we're going to talk about in a while, but did in the research for your book, did you come across any helicopter cockpit restoration projects?
There's quite a few out there, and in fact, I am writing a second book, a follow up to the first one, and yeah, I've got a links in there,
right.
And so there's a few kicking out about, but yeah, not as many as your kind of 1950s warbirds that seem so common at the moment. But yeah, there's a few helicopters.
Right. Okay. Sure. Okay. Then let's wrap up the news section then with the very impressive UK Carrier Strike Group 21, which is just heading off on a 6-month deployment, 26,000 miles, led by HMS Queen Elizabeth. Quite exciting, Tim. Not only have we got RAF F-35Bs, we've also got Merlins, Wildcat, Mark II Merlins, that are course anti-submarine. We've got Wildcats. We've got Mark IV Commandos. And more importantly, we've also got a squadron of US Marine Corps F-35Bs as well, fully integrated into Queen Elizabeth. That's quite exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that was always the plan to have the U.S. Marine Corps squadron integrated onto the, you know, they've already been kind of integrated into sort of like, you know, UK F-35 ops anyway. And it kind of it's almost returning the favor that, you know, they helped us train, you know, the UK train at Beaufort in the US. So it's returning the favour there. And obviously there's a long history going back in Harrier. So, 10 aircraft, I think, from the US Marine Corps, 8 from RAF. And also, obviously, you're taking the Americans along with you on the carrier strike group. It's going to have also a US frigate, but or even a couple of frigates, but there's interesting there is obviously you embark a squadron of US Marine Corps fighters on board with you, and it doesn't just kind of make you for a more powerful strike force from the F-35s. It means that anyone wanting to mess with your carrier is basically taking on the US as well, you know? So you basically got the biggest guy in the room, you know, yeah, who's kind of watching your back and as a sort of like that. So should be a flag waving kind of demonstration of Britain is finally back in carrier strike and sort of naval air power in the Asia Pacific, so which is obviously key area and where things are a little bit tense at the moment.
Yeah, interesting times. Well, let's leave the news there. Let's take a break, and we're going to come back to talk to Gavin about his new book, Restoration Force.
Hi, it's Dave Homewood here from the Wings Over New Zealand show. New Zealand's a very aviation-minded country, and we have a diverse range of stories out there to tell. The Wings Over New Zealand show brings you all sorts of stories, such as interviews with pilots or ground crew, World War II veterans, post-war Air Force personnel, airshow stories, historians, authors, warbird restorers, airline stories, recreational flyers and home builders, agricultural aviation such as top dressing, and a lot, lot more. We've got an extensive archive that you can go back to and listen to all of the shows, and there are new shows coming out all the time. The Wings Over New Zealand show, bringing you New Zealand aviation stories since 2011.
Gavin, fabulous book. I love the cover, by the way. But the subtitle is Grassroots Preservation of Civilian and Military Aircraft by Enthusiasts Worldwide. Now, the word aircraft is in there, but is that a tiny bit misleading?
This old chestnut. Yeah, I didn't realise that I would be entered into quite a few debates about that exact subject. I know there's quite a few enthusiasts out there who would argue it's not quite an aeroplane if it's missing the back end and wings. But it did make me think, can you call a cockpit an aircraft? But I love watches as well, and it's very much a case of you could see a watch in a jeweler's window, and if it didn't have its original case, well, it's still a Rolex, even though it doesn't have its strap on. So, yes, I've certainly come to the conclusion it's still an aircraft, it's still got its data plates, and it's still got the history, and it still smells of the oil. It very much is still the essence of that aircraft.
And the book is really all about cockpit restorations, isn't it? Why did you decide to write this book?
It's a well-asked question. There is actually in the book a guy called Jed, lovely guy, over in Kent. Now, he's actually got a complete Harrier and a complete Jaguar in his front garden. In his front garden. So it's not just cockpits, but it does form like 99% of the book. And originally, I was actually going to call it Garden Air Forces. I was really keen on that idea because I just wanted to capture these projects that weren't in museums. Everybody can walk into a museum, they can look them up online. So I just wanted to kind of capture those projects that were hiding away in people's garages, in barns, in their back garden, front garden. And it was just such great fun piecing it all together, actually. Quite a few of the projects, obviously, people know from the Facebook pages and all the enthusiast pages. But I think I did actually dig out quite a few that not many people have seen, which was brilliant.
Okay, so you sort of had an interest in restoration, didn't you, before you read the book? Because the next question really is, what is it? What is this appeal to enthusiasts about restoring cockpits? What is it? What's that? What's the thing that really floats the boat, sort of thing?
Yeah, I ask myself this a lot. I think the practical answer is space. Not many people have a property where you can keep an Avro Vulcan in the front garden or back garden. So that's actually one of the things that got me into cockpits. Was I remember as a little boy being on holiday and looking at an aeroplane magazine, and there was a little photograph in the ads at the back with a Vulcan cockpit section in the back of a terrace house garden, and I thought, hang on a minute, you don't need the whole plane. You can just have the front end. So I think space is a lot of it, but what you've got to bear in mind, and what I'd say to a lot of these people who think it's a shame to collect cockpits, is a lot of these planes were going to be scrapped. Hundreds and hundreds of warbirds and airframes were actually going to be scrapped. So a lot of these cockpiteers, they couldn't save the whole thing. So actually saving the cockpit is got to be a good thing, right?
Yeah. You used a term there. Is that what they're called? Cockpiteers.
Cockpiteers. I don't know if I've made that term up, but in the book. But yeah, I often refer to them as cockpiteers. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Is there a tension? I mean, given you're restoring kind of cockpits, and you're after the dials and all the authentic, control sticks, throttles, et cetera, is there a tension there between that kind of the cockpiteers and maybe people who are, I'm restoring this vintage aeroplane to actually fly, and your, head up display would be perfect for my my project. Is there a battle going on there between the kind of the people restoring it, kind of the full scale things to actually fly
I think that's a great question. To be fair, I think a lot of the cockpiteers, there's a lot of surplus out there, and they're quite happy to put in instruments that obviously are still original, but maybe don't work, damaged. Yeah. Yeah. And the airworthy ones that are deemed airworthy are just so expensive. It's probably beyond a lot of the cockpiteers' budget to actually install the instrument panels with original pieces. But some will. I must admit that I'm building a cockpit section of a Spitfire. Now I'm fully aware that it's like hen's teeth, a lot of the instruments. So with that in mind, I'm either sourcing broken Spitfire instruments, or we're just getting them made replicas or even 3D printed. So
right.
Cockpiteers will 3D print a lot of things, or just use plain old replicas.
Wow. Wow. Okay. Now, you mentioned a little project you're working on there, but this really started back with a lady called Hilda. Do you just want to explain and tell us a little bit about Hilda?
Yeah, so it was back in 2010, and I'd woken up from going to the pub, actually, and I had no memory of making a bid on eBay.
As one does.
Someone else in the book has done this as well. I looked on eBay, and I'd successfully bid on a chipmunk cockpit, WK638. And it was a bargain, you know, £500, needed a bit of work. I didn't want to renegade on the deal. So, yeah, I went and picked it up, came back. Luckily, it just fitted into my garage. Didn't think that through very well. And I did pretty much what everybody does is with their aircraft. So I created a little Facebook page, and I put all the historic photographs of her flying and all of its history. And then people were just contacting me out of the blue. I had a farmer up north say, do you know what? I've got the back end of WK638 if you want that. So actually we went and got the rear fuselage. It just snowballed from there, actually. And that was my first project. And at the time, my grandmother had just died. She left me a little bit of money in the will. So I used that money to buy the plane. And I christened her Hilda in memory of my nana.
Oh, okay. Lovely. Lovely. And there is a really wide spectrum that you cover in the book. And it's really easy to jump in and look at some of the Cold War stuff. There's a big focus on Cold War aircraft, isn't there? But there are some unusual ones. We talked about Jed, of course, who's got two airframes. And when you say in his garden, you mean in his garden. What were the slightly more unusual cockpits that you came across in your research for the book?
It's a good question. I mean, there's a guy called Steve, great guy. I mean, he's got a farm up in Scotland, and actually in his barn, if you looked at the photographs, it is like a museum. He's got one of the first Mark I Vulcans in there. He's got Jet Provost in there, Sea-Vixen and Canberra in there. I mean, that was a real memorable project. But I think for me, a chap in America who's got a B-52 cockpit, Steve Canby, and that was made by Boeing. Boeing were trying to bid for a simulator project with the United States Air Force, and it never came to fruition. So this one-off simulator that Boeing had made was just rotting away. I think that's one of the memorable ones, because I'd always, before I started writing the book, I'd thought, oh, I'd love a B-52, but just thought it would never be possible. But we got one.
And you talk there about Steve from the States. You've got examples here from all over the world, haven't you? The one that stood out for me, and you know, it has to be said, one of the best looking cockpits. Do you call them cockpits? Cockpits?
Yeah.
Okay. Cockpit. One of the best looking cockpits is Bob from Adelaide with the F4. Wow.
Yeah, wow.
That's amazing. How did you come across people like Bob on the other side of the world?
Yeah, Bob made me sad for putting that in United States Air Force colours.
I was confused when I read that bit, actually.
Yeah, no, she should be wearing RAF, but So actually, I'd always wanted to write this book. It'd been with me for a while, but with lockdown, I was put onto furlough, and you know, I had a couple of months just literally sat on my backside, but I couldn't go anywhere. So what I did was I put an advert on eBay in the aviation section, and I just said help wanted, and I just wrote a brief description of what I planned to do, and yeah, just. My inbox was just filling up with guys all over the world, actually, just saying, I've got a project. How do I get in touch with you?
Yeah.
So, I literally wrote the book without leaving my house, and people from, yeah, all over the world were sending me their photographs and their whole life stories, really, which was just incredible.
Wow. Okay. Now, again, I just want to pick out another example, because I suppose the uniqueness of some of these, you know, we talk about an F4 Phantom, we all know and can picture that in our heads. What is slightly more challenging is a Sukhoi 22.
Yeah. I didn't expect that one to come out the woodwork either, yeah.
No, I mean, when I was reading the book, you know, I've got a bit of a soft spot for old Russian and Soviet aircraft, just because I just find them fascinating. I didn't expect to see this in the book, though.
No, and so he, Paul, originally contacted me that he had a Jaguar, and I was like, brilliant. I don't think I've got a Jaguar apart from Jed, so we'll take that. And then when I was actually looking through his photographs he'd sent me, there was the front end of a MiG. And I was like, hello, what's a MiG doing also in your garage? So he sent me photos of that. And then obviously more pictures were coming through, and he had the Sukhoi as well. So, yeah, just amazing collection that he's got. I have got cockpit envy of Paul, actually. That's, really, really good stuff.
It's quite impressive. The paint scheme's impressive. Some of our Australian listeners may have seen it because it has featured at the Avalon air show a few years back. So yeah. They might have seen the aircraft there. Let's talk about some of the nuts and bolts then. Tim talked about the challenges of sourcing parts and things like that. How challenging can this be? You know, Sukhoi to a Spitfire to, you know, to a B-52. We all know there are boneyards out there, but getting some of the older parts really tricky.
Yeah, and I think the availability is there, but I think what's now changing is just the pricing. So you know, people know they've got hen's teeth or stuff rare as hen's teeth. So we just see stuff advertised that is just astronomical, and I think that's some of the issue now. But you know you only have to go on eBay. I keep referring to that, but it is a great source, and you can find pretty much anything on there. But as I said, I know a lot of people now just that there's some amazing replica instruments that you just can't tell. And there's a network of people on the Facebook instrument and cockpit collectors kind of forum. And there's just people there who make replica instruments. So yeah, we're making our way around it, but and a lot of it is localized as well. So like Steve with his B-52, I know where he's based. The Boeing factory was just up the road, so for him, I guess parts were quite ready. So yeah, I think a lot of it is where you're based as well, but they're getting harder to find.
And sorry, go on, Tim.
I was going to say, I mean, do you think with is there a specific type of aircraft or period that is kind of attracts people the most, and two, I'm thinking of all the kind of boneyard was mentioned, all the grounded aircraft from COVID-19. Is that going to be an opportunity for cockpit restorers to go in there and I don't know whether get the front half an A380. I don't know where you stick that, but there's all these airliners now that aren't going to come back into service.
Yeah, well, for some time now, Kemble Airfield, or the Cotswolds Airport, as it's known, for years, you could approach them and say, look, you know, I want an A320 cockpit, and, you know, £5,000 and it's yours, pretty stripped out. I think the problem with the airlines is that, one, the transportation, and they're pretty big as well. So I think the attraction of, like, the Cold War jets or the Jet Provost, the training aircraft like the Chipmunk, the Provosts, it's just their size, although they weigh a couple of tons probably, but they're actually just quite easy to store, whereas but the second book we've got some airlines in there, but I think the smaller stuff, the jets, the 1950s, as you say, Cold War jets, the Canberras are really popular, and I guess just because there was quite a surplus of them around when they scrapped them, but even those are quite hefty and big to store.
Are you fascinated by aviation and its history? Are you hungry to expand your knowledge? Then you're ready for The Aviation Historian. A compact format quarterly journal, The Aviation Historian is a cross between a magazine and a book. It uses the best authors and the best picture sources to explore the less well-known paths of the history of flying. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey, that's me, and Nick Stroud, so you can trust it for quality, accuracy, and sheer passion for the subject. The Aviation Historian. We're print, we're digital, but we're not in the shops. Order us online and find out more at theaviationhistorian.com. Are you ready for it?
One of the examples in the book, towards the end, Gavin's the BAC 111. That's a lovely little cockpit, isn't it?
And it breaks my heart, actually. That's on eBay now.
Okay.
I saw it. I literally saw it a couple of days ago. So that's I'd love that. But £4,900 and it's yours. And the beauty of that is it's modular. So obviously it comes to bits, and you can put it through doorways. And if your missus will allow you, have that in the spare bedroom. But but I love that project.
Shame. Go on, Tim.
Oh, I was going to ask. I mean, one of the things that you say is one of the things that's mentioned is you know, it's a secretive world. I mean, is that just because it's in people's sheds, garages, you know, kind of spare rooms, or is it a case of you know, first rule of cockpit club? We don't talk about cockpit club. I mean, I know some people will take them on the you know, take them on the road and take them to air shows and stuff and display. You've got Cockpit Fest, is that right?
Yeah, and that's what I'll kind of mention a bit later on just as a kind of promotion. But so a lot of the cockpits there will attend Cockpit Fest at Newark. But there's a few projects in there, well, quite a few in the book where you know, they really pleaded with me to keep it very vague. So you've only got the county. You might have a picture of their sheds, but there's nothing in there to explain where they're based. And that's purely for, you know, some of those just aren't doing the tours, and they're kept quite secretive. But it's not to shy them away from the aviation enthusiasts. It's just that, you know, it's a lump of metal worth a lot of money. I think a lot of it is just worried about security, and, you know, it just getting stolen.
And Gavin, you mentioned the BAC 111 there on eBay. I mean, one of these, what does buying one of the older, maybe unrestored cockpits cost? And what's the sort of cost of bringing it up to the spec we see in the book? You know, just ballpark. Yeah. Are we talking tens? Are we talking fives? Are we talking hundreds? I just got no concept of what's involved here.
Maybe About 10 years or so ago, you could pick up a Buccaneer cockpit that was pretty a shell inside, and you'd probably get that for £1,000, £1,500. Whereas now, just even as a shell in quite a poor state, you're going to be knocking on the door of £5,000 easily.
Wow.
And something like Robin's Buccaneer that features in the book, a Gulf War veteran, he's done that really well, and £30,000 quite happily.
Right, that's the one on the cover, isn't it?
That's correct. Yeah, yeah. That's my cover. Yeah,
yeah. That's a stunning shot. That's a stunning shot.
Do you ever get are these people in demand also from film companies and people doing documentaries and I'm doing a documentary on 1991, I don't know, Gulf War, and I need a Buccaneer. We're kind of filming and acting.
There's a chap in there, Tony Dyer, who's been a real big influence to me. Now, he builds Spitfires, Spitfire cockpits. He's got Hurricane projects. He's what a chap with the links. Now, I know he's done filming. They've come knocking on his door for the Hurricane and did the Battle of Britain scramble film. I think you do get film companies kind of pick off the people that they need. But there is firms out there, certainly with like the airline cockpits and what have you. And I do know of people who do keep the cockpits purely for filming purposes. So they don't tend to be the smaller individuals just with one or two cockpits, but it does happen.
And Gavin, do you have a favourite? Outside of Hilda, of course.
Outside of Hilda? it's a good question. Probably Steve's Vulcan, I think. I do love the Vulcan.
And as things open up, are there any plans, particularly for research for a further book, for you to go and visit some of these?
Yeah, no, I will do. Very much so. And as the second book's coming along, although it's gone very international, the second book, a lot of the UK ones, I will certainly make a point of coming to visit, and it'd be nice to get my own photographs. But yeah, for sure, I will go and visit them. And even the people in the first book, I kind of know their whole life stories, and it would be lovely just to go and meet them. But hoping this year we'll see them in Cockpit Fest.
And
what would be a top tip then for someone looking to get into this sort of like hobby of you're going in there and you go along to Kemble or somewhere, or you look on eBay and you think, oh, hang on, there's a Allhawk, a Hunter front section here. I'll blow some cash on that. What would your advice be?
So before I started the book, I wasn't on social media, and I realised the first thing I've got to do is get on Facebook. So what I would recommend is go on to Facebook and the Instrument and Cockpit Collectors Aviation Forum. That's run by a chap called Dave Taylor, who knows absolutely everybody and anybody. And you would just put a post on there saying, this is what I'm looking for. Does anyone know of a cockpit that's going for sale? So you'll probably avoid the high eBay prices, and it's a really lovely bunch of people. It's like a small family, and you'll just get inundated with messages of people who know of a project that's for sale or coming up for sale, and they'll kind of nurture you through it all.
This is fascinating. I'm trying to rack my brains here, Gavin and Tim, actually, to another mode of transport that does anything like this, and I just can't think of anything. It's almost unique, isn't it? Obviously aeroplanes are, but I just can't think of anything else like this. It's fascinating, and it just seems to be a real passion and enjoyment, it really comes out in the book, for those who have done the work. And obviously there's the whole pride of where they're at. Is the project ever finished, though?
It's all about the journey, I think. But you see the cockpits change hands quite regularly, and I think that's because once someone's, we're only custodians of them. We don't ever own a cockpit. We're just custodians. So you do see them pass from hands to hands, and I think that's just people take it as far as they want, or they want a new project. But I think it's just a boyhood dream, really, isn't it, to sit in a fighter plane? And it's only at a stage when you can afford to buy one that people do it, I think. Yeah.
And Tim, you've sent us a picture of something your buddy has done. That looks quite impressive.
So this is a replica Spitfire cockpit that he's made from scratch, and people know, regular listeners will know I'm a bit of a flight sim nut. So installed his simulator in that. So wow. He's got a authentic Spitfire cockpit to just the mixture and flick the magnetos and all the rest of it. Do people fit flight sims in some of the cockpits in your book, or the people you've been in your circles?
Yeah, we've got a Hawker Hunter in the first book, and that's all rigged up to a sim in a shed, which is just fantastic. It's what dreams are made of. And there's a chap in Holland called Nico, who's built a scratch built 737 cockpit. Well, it's a flight simulator, but actually, if you were to see a photograph of it, even with the screens on, you would just not know it. You're not sat in a real flight deck. It's incredible. So yeah, of course. But I'd say the hardcore cockpiteers, they don't put screens in front. It's purely about preservation and restoration.
And does that include, Gavin, having things like some of the electrics connected? I noticed that some of them do connect small parts. But is a restoration complete when it's fully powered, or?
No, not necessarily. I think probably the last thing that someone would say is done is the paint job. Once it's painted back to its original colours, I think that's probably it. But no, it just depends on what level of degree of restoration they're going to do. But with cockpiteers, it's two things: is it preservation or is it restoration? And there's people will argue which is best, but in my mind, they're both best. But if you're It's all got to be good, and if you're going to restore it back to how it came off the flight line 50 years ago, then that's also just as good.
Great stuff. Well, the book is Restoration Force: Grassroots Preservation of Civilian and Military Aircraft by Enthusiasts Worldwide. It's published by Grub Street. Where can we get hold of the book online, and more importantly, where can we find you online, Gavin?
So you can buy the book directly from Grub Street Publishers, WH Smith's, Amazon, Waterstones. All major book clubs. And I can be found on Facebook as well. So yeah, I'm as I say, now on social media.
Okay. Well, if you send us a link, we'll put that in with the show notes so people can find you. Absolutely fascinating topic. Yeah. Tim, anything before we move on?
I would just sort of ask, why do you think the grassroots scene is important, or compared to, say, the big or even small sort of aviation museums? What do you think it kind of brings to, I suppose, warbird or the historic aircraft scene that museums can't provide?
Well, a lot of these cockpits, they're restored and they're kept and lovely, brought back to life in people's gardens, sheds, garages, or what have you. But a lot of them do end up in museums.
Right.
So they're not on a permanent basis, but a lot of them are loaned out. So my front cover, for instance, Robin's Buccaneer. You know, he restored that, but that's currently at Newark. So the Jason's Vampire, that's at South Wales Aviation Museum, just being restored. So although they will end up at a museum, and maybe that is the right place, it's just as they're being restored, it's a lot of it is home based.
Right.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Okay then, over to promoting aerospace, shout outs, mentions and promotions for the sector. I'll kick things off and I'm going to promote another podcast, actually another aviation podcast. As you know, we run the aviation podcast group on Facebook, and one of the programs we promote is called Pilot Episodes, and the latest episode is titled Gulf War POW Interview with Dave Waddingham. Now, this is an amazing account by Air Commodore Dave Waddington, CBE, on his personal experience of the first Gulf War when he was shot down and taken prisoner. It's a real fascinating insight and a story that I don't know if it has been published. I hadn't heard of it, but he speaks with such grace about the horrors of being a POW at that time. It's really fascinating. So highly recommended. I'll put a link in the show notes, but that's Pilot Episodes, the podcast. Tim, anything from you?
Yeah, I've got a competition done by Rolls-Royce, who are set to hopefully to fly the world's fastest electric powered airplane. They're hoping to fly it in May, and they're looking for kids aged 5 to 11 or 6 to 18 to design the helmet for their chief test pilot, Phil O'Dell. So there is a competition going out, and your young person could be part of aviation history by helping design his helmet.
Excellent.
For this potentially record-breaking aircraft. How cool is that?
And I think you can download a template, can't you, yep, Tim, and colour it in or paint it or design it on that. So, it's not a great deal of effort, but potentially a lot of fun for the youngsters.
And it's also in aid of, it's also in conjunction with aviation charity Fly to Help as well.
Ah, of course. Great cause. Gavin, you mentioned Cockpit Fest.
Yeah, so I'd like to mention Cockpit Fest. So it's held annually at Newark over at Nottinghamshire. So this year, obviously last year it couldn't go ahead, but this year it's the 28th, 29th and 30th of August. Really good weekend, and that's where people with the cockpits and projects will exhibit the aircraft all weekend. And you'll have flying events, you'll have stalls, you have an aero jumbo, and yeah, just a really good get together. And there you'll get to speak to all the people who do it. And if it does intrigue you and you want to know a little bit more, then certainly worth heading down there. And a lot of the proceeds do go to charity as well, so it is a charitable event. So yeah, worth a good weekend out.
Yeah, good shout out. Right, that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. And we'd also like to thank the extended family of supporters, Mick Hokey at the Aviation Historian and Simon Jakubowski at the Aviation Enthusiast Book Club. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. Programs produced with a Creative Commons license. So, Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, well, when I'm not looking for F-14 cockpits on eBay, at RES Tim R on Twitter, and the Royal Aeronautical Society is www.aerosociety.com.
And you can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find us at the Aviation Extended Twitter and Facebook pages. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye, everybody. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from our guest, Gavin Hoffman.
Goodbye, folks.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Knowing how to recognise a stall being taught like visually and the basic PPL, it wouldn't bother me.
Thanks for listening to Extended. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
Today, I'm joined by Tim Robinson, and Tim is, of course... that isn't Tim Robinson.
that outtick has to come in, yeah.
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.